Over the past several lectures, we have traced the development of American Orthodoxy from its early years through the post-war period. We saw how Orthodoxy initially operated in a relatively fluid environment where denominational boundaries were often unclear and rabbis focused primarily on maintaining Jewish affiliation and communal continuity. As conservative Judaism developed its own institutions, theology, and halachic approach, Orthodoxy increasingly responded by defining its identity and boundaries more clearly. In our last lecture, we examined how this process accelerated after World War II through controversies over mixed seating, driving to the Shul on Shabbos, interdenominational cooperation, and the relationship between Orthodoxy and modern scholarship. We also explored disagreements between figures such as Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Yitz Greenberg over how Orthodoxy should engage modern culture while remaining faithful to Halacha. Today, we turn to one of the most important questions in contemporary Orthodox history. Did modern Orthodoxy experience a significant shift to the right in the closing decades of the 20th century? Many observers argue that modern Orthodoxy became more traditionalist, placed greater emphasis on rabbinic authority and yeshiva learning, and became more cautious about innovation. Historian Adam Furziger addresses this question in his book Beyond Sectarianism, The Realignment of American Orthodox Judaism. Building on Charles Liebman's distinction between modern Orthodoxy's more inclusive church model and Haredi Orthodoxy's more separatist sect model, Furziger argues that the boundaries between the communities became less rigid. While Haredi Orthodoxy became somewhat more engaged with the broader world, parts of modern Orthodoxy moved rightward, adopting practices and values once associated primarily with the Haredi community. He points to the growing influence of Israeli yeshivos, greater emphasis on intensive Torah study, increased deference to rabbinic authority, and stricter standards in areas such as kashrus and tznius. Modern Orthodoxy did not abandon its commitment to higher education, professional careers, or participation in broader society, but many sought to combine those commitments with greater religious rigor and stronger identification with yeshiva culture. To explore this question, we'll focus on one of the most controversial issues of the period, women's tefillah groups. The debate surrounding women's prayer groups touched on much larger questions about halachic change, communal authority, feminism, tradition, and the future of modern direction of modern Orthodoxy. In many ways, they became a testing ground for the broader struggle over how modern Orthodoxy should balance commitment to tradition with the challenges and opportunities of modern life. In approaching this topic, it is useful to begin with a framing question that already points to two very different ways of interpreting the phenomenon of women's tefillah groups. Were these groups primarily an outgrowth of the feminist movement of the 1960s and 1970s, an attempt to challenge, revise, or even rupture traditional assumptions about the roles of men and women in Jewish life, or were they instead the continuation of a longer internal development within American Jewish life, a growing desire among women for greater participation, presence, and meaning within communal synagogue worship? To understand why this question arises at all, we first need to place women's tefillah groups in their broader cultural and historical context. As Sylvia Fishman notes in an article written in 1989, feminism in the 1960s and 1970s emerged out of the same set of social forces that produced the civil rights movement, anti-war activism, and a wider anti-establishment ethos. Many women who participated in these movements came to see themselves as part of an oppressed group and began rethinking traditional assumptions about gender roles in American life. For some strands of feminism, even the family itself was understood as a structure that confined women to the domestic sphere. Unsurprisingly, religious communities often responded with strong resistance. In the 1960s and early 1970s, feminist ideas were frequently denounced from synagogue pulpits and treated as a threat to traditional religious and family norms. By the late 1960s and early 1970s, a distinct Jewish feminist consciousness had begun to take shape. Jewish women started to ask how the broader feminist critique applied to Jewish communal and religious life. One of the earliest organized expressions of this was Ezrat Nashim, a small New York-based group that became the first contemporary Jewish feminist organization to address not only social and civic concerns, but explicitly religious ones. In 1972, Ezrat Nashim issued a public call to the conservative movement demanding that women be counted in the minyan, fully included in public religious participation, trained as rabbis and cantors, granted expanded leadership roles in synagogues, allowed to serve as witnesses, and given equal standing in areas of personal status, such as divorce law. These demands reflected a broader rethinking of women's place in Jewish life and contributed to major institutional changes in the non-Orthodox world, including the ordination of Sally Priceand as the first female Reform rabbi in 1972 and Amy Eilberg as the first female conservative rabbi in 1985. It is against this backdrop that women's tefillah groups began to emerge in Orthodox settings. On one reading, they can be understood as part of the broader feminist movement, an attempt to reconfigure inherited gender roles and challenge long-standing assumptions about authority, ritual leadership, and religious participation. On another reading, however, they belong to a very different historical trajectory, one that is less about rupture and more about participation. The second approach draws attention to a longer pattern in American Jewish history in which women increasingly sought fuller involvement in synagogue life even prior to the rise of contemporary feminism. Carla Goldman in Beyond the Synagogue Gallery shows that already in the 19th and early 20th centuries, women were gradually moving from passive observers in synagogue life to more active participants. Even within traditional synagogue structures, women organized sisterhoods, educational initiatives, and charitable activities that gave them a growing public religious presence, often in response to American expectations of religious participation and volunteerism. These changes were not always ideological in intent. They often reflected practical and spiritual desires to be more fully integrated into communal religious life. Jenna Weissman-Joselit makes a similar argument in her discussion of women's evolving ritual roles. She shows how forms of women's religious expression often developed out of existing domestic and communal practices rather than appearing as sharp breaks from tradition. What later looks like innovation can often be traced to earlier, less formal modes of religious life in which women already played meaningful roles. From this perspective, women's tefillah groups can be seen not as a sudden departure, but as one more step in a longer process of bringing women's religious energy from the margins of synagogue life into its more structured center. Taken together, these two frameworks offer different ways of understanding the origins of women's tefillah groups. One emphasizes the impact of modern feminism and the possibility of ideological challenge to traditional structures. The other emphasizes continuity, participation, and the long-standing desire of women to engage more fully and meaningfully in communal tefillah. The significance of the phenomenon, then, depends on, in part on which historical story one sees it as continuing, and whether it is understood primarily as a moment of rupture or as part of a much longer process of religious deepening from within. It is also worth noting that the Orthodox response to women's tefillah groups often reflects a very different assumption about which of these two narratives is most accurate, and therefore a very different way of interpreting what is actually driving the desire for them in the first place. A handful of Orthodox day schools introduced Talmud instruction for girls in the 1940s, but these efforts did not initially generate significant momentum. The issue gained greater visibility on October 11, 1977, and Rav Soloveitchik delivered the inaugural Talmud lecture at Stern College for Women. Although the establishment of advanced Torah study opportunities for women represented an important development within modern Orthodoxy, the broader expansion of women's Torah learning remained gradual. At the same time, a small number of women's groups that had originally gathered for Torah study began meeting more regularly for prayer, often on Shabbos or Rosh Chodesh. These groups were careful in both practice and rhetoric. When reading from a Torah scroll, many describe the activity as limud rather than kriya, emphasizing its educational character and avoiding language that might suggest the creation of a parallel synagogue service. More generally, many modern Orthodox women involved in these initiatives avoided explicitly feminist labels. Rivka Hout, one of the founders of the Women's Tefillah Network and later a leader of the Women of the Wall, who organized the first women's prayer service at the Kotel, deliberately sought legitimacy from mainstream modern Orthodox institutions rather than positioning herself as part of an external feminist movement. The emergence of women's prayer groups took place against a broader cultural and denominational backdrop. The 1980s were, in many respects, a politically and culturally conservative period in American society, and proponents of feminist causes were often portrayed as anti-family. Within the Jewish world, developments in conservative Judaism heightened Orthodox sensitivities. In October 1983, the faculty of the Jewish Theological Seminary voted 34-8 to admit women to its rabbinical program. Critics of women's prayer groups frequently linked the Orthodox phenomenon to conservative Judaism's move towards women's ordination. Conservative Rabbi Harold Schulweis explicitly connected JTS's decision to ordain women with Stern College's recently established Talmud program for women, reinforcing concerns among Orthodox leaders that seemingly limited innovations could lead to more sweeping changes. Despite rabbinic opposition in some quarters, women's prayer groups continued to spread and their participants increasingly sought rabbinic guidance and halakhic support. One of the central halakhic questions concerned whether women could recite the blessings before and after Torah reading. In 1990, Rabbi Avi Weiss published Women at Prayer, a comprehensive defense of women's tefillah groups that became an influential guide for many participants. But 6 years before Rabbi Weiss's book on this topic, the controversy reached a new stage in 1984. The Jewish press published an article about women's prayer groups that suggested that the Rabbinical Council of America held a more favorable view of the phenomena than it actually did. Rabbi Louis Bernstein, then president of the RCA, responded to a letter clarifying his opposition. And he said the following. This is an article in the Jewish press. He said that I stated an issue, and he said in his presidential address, he stated an issue which I respectfully disagree with Rabbi Gilbert Klapperman. Apparently, Rabbi Gilbert Klapperman was more inclined towards women's tefillah groups. Rabbi Louis Bernstein wrote, "The synagogue must remain inviolate. I am saddened by occasional reports of women's minyanim and the like from our colleagues. Orthodoxy and orthodoxy alone educates women from kindergarten through college and beyond. I am not at all impressed by veiled warnings that we stand to lose much if we don't ride with the tide. We heard the same argument on mixed pews. Unfortunately, so many stood their ground. Torah study for women, yes. Co-opting of our most able men and women for communal leadership, yes. Maintaining the traditional sanctity of the synagogue, most emphatically, yes. This clearly indicates that I disagree with Rabbi Gilbert Klapperman's point of view." So he clarified his opposition to women's tefillah groups, and he disputed the views attributed to Rabbi Gilbert Klapperman of Congregation Beth Shalom in Lawrence. Now Rabbi Irwin Hout subsequently entered the debate. He was the husband of Rivka Hout. So in his letter to the Jewish press, he first said that these gatherings should be called davening groups rather than minyanim, reflecting his desire that the terminology remain consistent with halachic categories and values. He also argued that the practice enjoyed the support of leading rabbinic authorities. He says, "The groups under discussion are completely halachic, being conducted in accordance with halachic guidelines prescribed by halachic authorities who are truly gedolei olam." And he writes at the end of his letter, "I suggest that the establishment of such groups constitutes a step in the right direction, which most surely deserves the approval of Rabbi Bernstein and the Rabbinical Council of America rather than their censure." Now, Rabbi, upon reading this, the next letter, that letter was October 24th, 1984. The first letter by Rabbi Bernstein was July 6th, 1984. Rabbi Irwin Hout's letter was October 24th, 1984. And Rabbi Bernstein then writes another letter in the Jewish press, September 7th, 1984. And here he challenges this claim. He writes, "May I suggest that he specify who the Gedolei," referring to Rabbi Hout, "may he specify who the Gedolei Olam are and clearly cite chapter and verse where they have written on the subject. Only then can we determine whether Minyanim are halakhically a step in the right direction." So on September 21st, in a letter to Jewish press, Rabbi Hout writes the following. He said, "Rabbi Mordechai Tendler, writing on behalf of his grandfather, Harav Moshe Feinstein, on Harav Moshe's stationery dated 4 Sivan 5742, responds to the query of a practicing rabbi by sending forth guidelines for such groups. He states in substance that the women are of pure motivation and not rebellious against Torah mitzvot. What reason could there be to prevent them from praying together? And they are also permitted to read from a Sefer Torah." Another response was sent by Chief Rabbi Shlomo Goren, Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi of Israel, offering practical halachic guidance to a specific group of women who had asked him how to conduct themselves in connection with such tefillah groups. So he cites both Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Goren. So then Rabbi Bernstein writes back on November 23rd, 1984. He addresses these points, Rabbi Bernstein. He says, "It was not Rabbi Feinstein himself, but his grandson who interpreted his views," as Rabbi Hout correctly stated, "upon which support for Minyanim for the ladies is based. Even a cursory reading of that response will make it immediately clear to the reader that Rabbi Feinstein's discussion is entirely theoretical, and he specifically states that for all practical purposes, a women's minyan is inconceivable in the halachic sense. I discussed the issue at length with Rabbi Moshe Tendler, Rabbi Feinstein's son-in-law, who stated that his father-in-law views such proposals as motzi laz al harishonim. The issue was subsequently clarified in a subsequent letter by Mordechai Tendler after consulting his grandfather. I quote that letter. As stated in my letter, the detailed discussion was purely in a theoretical sense. My grandfather pragmatically feels that the possibility of a group of women, or for that matter, men, existing in any one community which will fulfill the lengthy philosophical criteria mentioned in his printed tshuva is extremely remote. Therefore, realistically speaking, he doesn't recommend or actually condone the establishment of women's prayer groups. Then Rabbi Bernstein deals with Rabbi Gorin's response, and he says, this response was clearly marked private and not for publication, and the chief rabbi is both astonished and resentful at its circulation. Its content is similar to Rabbi Feinstein's. It too is the theoretical discussion of a specific case, and therefore requested it remain private lest it be misunderstood, which is precisely what has occurred. Rabbi Gorin has specifically authorized me to state in his behalf that he is unequivocally opposed to women's minyanim, that they are davar she'ein das chachamim nocha himenu, something displeasing to rabbinic opinion. So the so that's what Rabbi Lewis Bernstein writes back. In any case, then in response to that, Rabbi Hout basically says that he writes a letter back on December 14th, where he basically cites Rav Moshe's tshuva, and he interprets it to say that Rav Moshe Feinstein gave criteria that if the women are l'shem shemayim, then nothing should prevent them from praying together, and he argues that they are l'shem shemayim. So we have this going back and forth among this Rabbi Hout, husband of Rivka Hout, and Rabbi Lewis Bernstein, president of the RCA. Seeking a definitive statement, Rabbi Bernstein invited five YU Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Herschel Schachter, Rav Nissim Alpert, Rabbi Abba Bronspiegel, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, and Rabbi Yehuda Parnas to issue a formal response. The timing is significant because Rabbi Soloveitchik was still affiliated with YU, but was by then severely limited by illness and no longer in a position to provide leadership on controversial public issues. Moshe Feinstein was still alive. He would pass away in 1986, but he too was unable to offer further clarification. In a letter dated 12 Kislev 5745, November 25th, 1984, and it was published in 1985, the response strongly opposes women's prayer groups, women's hakafos, and on Simchas Torah, and women's Megillah readings. The signatories argue that these practices were included ziyuf haTorah. It's a distortion of Torah values. It's shinoi. They write it's a shinoi uporesh, shinoi gamor maod bolet b'msorat avosena. It's a major change from our tradition of our ancestors. It's poritz geder. You're breaching the fence. B'minhag Yisrael, among the customs of the Jewish people. It's chshash chukas akum. It's an imitation of non-Jewish religious models. Rav Schachter later expanded these arguments in a lengthy essay, Tzi'ilach Bikvei Atzon, published in Beis Yitzchak, YU's Torah Journal. There he articulated both halachic and meta-halachic objections, emphasizing concerns about Mesorah, communal norms, and the ideological motivations underlying the movement. The response, however, did not end the debate. Significant pushback followed from rabbis and lay people alike. Importantly, the controversy was not simply a top-down struggle between rabbinic authorities and activists. There was also substantial grassroots resistance to women's prayer groups within the Orthodox community, and many Orthodox women themselves remain indifferent or unconvinced. Even Blue Greenberg, one of the most prominent advocates for expanded women's participation, viewed women's prayer groups as an imperfect interim solution rather than an ideal endpoint, preferring forms of religious life in which men and women could participate together more fully, something like partnership minyanim. The subsequent history illustrates the limits of both the movement and its opposition. The RCA ultimately defeated a motion that would have adopted the Rosh Yeshiva's position as binding organizational policy, demonstrating that even strong rabbinic opposition did not produce a communal consensus. In the minutes of the RCA, Rabbi Bernstein writes that he did not ask this question of the Rosh Yeshiva in the name of the RCA. He asked the question as an individual. And when he received the tshuva, he was asking, he was writing as an individual and informed the RCA that the tshuva was available for anyone to use. So the executive of the RCA declared that the opinion of the five Rosh Yeshiva was not an official position of the RCA. So even though it was a major setback for the women's tefillah groups from the letter of the five Rosh Yeshiva, it's fascinating that the RCA does not adapt it as official policy. At the same time, women's prayer groups never became widespread throughout modern Orthodoxy. Advanced Talmud study for women expanded only gradually, and the broader movement generated less enthusiasm than many of its advocates had hoped. In retrospect, the debates of the 1980s reveal a set of aspirations, both among proponents and opponents, that remained only partially fulfilled. Women's prayer groups became a visible symbol and in larger struggles over authority, tradition, and change, but they never developed into a mass movement capable of transforming the Orthodox mainstream. Looking back, the story of women's tefillah groups in the 1980s is less about a clear win or loss for either side, and more about how modern Orthodoxy was working through big questions about change and continuity. These groups became a focal point for much larger issues: how Orthodoxy relates to feminism, how it understands tradition, and who has the authority to shape religious life. For some, they reflect broader cultural shifts towards greater female participation and religious expression. For others, they raise serious concerns about crossing boundaries that define Orthodox practice. One of the central questions in understanding women's tefillah groups is not only what motivated them, but how they were framed and interpreted. Were they primarily a feminist project aimed at reshaping traditional religious roles, or were they better understood as part of a more gradual internal evolution towards greater points of religious entry and participation for women within synagogue life? That distinction mattered because how the phenomenon was categorized shaped how it was evaluated, and also what people thought it might eventually lead to. In the end, there was no single resolution that settled the matter for everyone. Rabbinic opposition was strong, but it did not fully unify the community, and the groups themselves also remained limited in size and influence. The result was something in between, not full acceptance, but also not disappearance. This is also why it is too simple to describe this period as straightforward shift to the right in modern Orthodoxy. What we actually see is more complicated. At the same time, there were shifts to the right, shifts to the left, and a strong desire among many rabbinic leaders to hold the center and maintain a shared communal framework. All of these dynamics were happening within modern Orthodox leadership itself, often in response to the same pressures and events. Seen this way, women's tefillah groups did not transform the community, but they did highlight the ongoing tension between tradition and change that defined this period. In our next session, we will continue this conversation with the emergence of open Orthodoxy, which will further illuminate how these competing impulses developed in the decades that followed.